But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning and welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shodell, broadcasting to all you foodies out there, and I'm here with producer and co-host Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. We're in for a warm weekend.
Lovely. I like warm weekends, you know. Warm, sunny weekends, right? So everybody can go out and play. And big time this weekend. It's Father's Day, right?
Yes.
Today.
Yes. So how does that translate in the world of restaurants?
Well, Father's Day was never really a big deal. You know, I think on Father's Day what people do is, you know, they hand dad a spatula, a tie, and, you know, hopefully let him watch the U.S. Open in peace or whatever. It's not the, you know, Shakespearean tragedy that Mother's Day is, with breakfast in bed and roses and carnations and flowers and dinner and all that. And it's probably appropriate. I mean, I think dads have a little bit of a lesser role in the kids' lives to some degree than moms do. But it's becoming a little more popular to go out. I've seen some increased business in the last couple of years on Father's Day. But it's still, I think it's still more of a barbecue day, you know. Which is what we can talk about today, too, by the way, if you want to do some cooking out in the backyard and maybe give dad some tips if he's going to be on the grill. If not, you know, you can cook for him and let him sit there and enjoy himself. So we can get into some of that. That might be fun.
That would be nice.
But I'm excited this weekend because I love to watch the U.S. Open golf tournament. And, you know, it's always the big four major tournaments are always my favorites to watch: the Masters, the PGA, the U.S. Open, and the Open Championship in England. And what's great about this one this year is it's being played in California, which means there's a 3-hour time difference, and I may even get to watch the end of it, you know.
Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully it's been, an exciting tournament so far. They got, you know, a couple of guys in contention there that are pretty close. And, you know, they always say that you can't win it on the first you can't win it on the first day, but you can certainly lose it on the first day. And some of my favorites haven't been doing so well. I think Jordan Spieth is like 6 over, whatever, and Mickelson was way over. So we'll see what happens today at the end of the day and who's going to win this thing and carry on. So anyway, you have any favorite Father's Day things that you do? Do you go out? Do your kids lavish you with expensive wines?
Within my family, there's a heritage event that always happens out in Commack, Kings Park area. My cousins had hosted a barbecue every year, and now their daughter, Bonnie, actually hosts it.
Oh, yeah, legacy. Yeah,
so it's really a pretty cool thing. And in addition, this year, we're having a Sweet 16 that had been moved around a lot during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And that's actually happening on Saturday evening.
Oh, yeah.
So we have some additional family flying in for that. Which will be pretty cool. So there's going to be a nice gathering. And then my cousin's actually staying in. They're from San Diego. An interesting tidbit is my cousin partnered with the Indians out in San Diego and had a casino. It's still running. He's just sold his share of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really knew what to expect until I went out for another family event. And I arrive at the Palo Resort, and lo and behold, it's like a Mohegan Sun. I mean, it was incredible.
Big, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. And this is my cousin Jerry, and he also was involved in Las Vegas, developing the old part of Las Vegas with the
frontier
LED, yeah. LED lighting.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he's made his mark out there. But the casino in San Diego is, some people say, is like the most perfect environment.
The weather,
weather is supposed to be, you know, always good.
Yeah, I've been out there. It's nice.
And but we had a good time. I guess we went to the aquarium out there, and there's the Hotel Coronado.
Yeah, Coronado.
Which is very famous. I think there's been books featuring that locale.
Coronado's a beautiful place. I mean, that's where the SEALs practice, too. That's where there's a big Navy base there in Coronado, and that's where the Navy SEALs train. Interesting stuff. I watched a movie on them. Those guys are hardcore, you know. But, yeah, you know, I've been to San Diego once. I was out there for a wedding. It was a destination wedding. My niece had gotten married out there. And I'm not a big California fan for some reason. I like Northern California better. up around Napa. You know, go figure, there's wines up there. But I just like the topography better, and I like the weather better. It's a little cooler up there. But it's, you know, California is certainly a beautiful place. I mean, you have that juxtaposition of mountains and sea. It's, you know, great place to hang, and the weather's always good. And some of my favorite restaurants, you know, have been in California, Northern California, San Francisco area.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I've been to some great places out there. In fact, I haven't been there in a long time, and I'm due to go out again. I'm probably going to go, I think, in January, because it's just been probably 15 years since I've been there, and I'd like to go recheck it out. You know, there's new wineries open all the time. And, you know, being in the business, we get to, you know, get to go there and get these guided tours and stuff, you know, so you take advantage of that.
That's,
it's always
pretty
fun.
Cool.
Yeah, sometimes they even put you up. They'll give you, you know, hotel accommodations or whatever. So it's nice. It's nice to go out there and visit the homies and see what they're doing, you know. But anyway, should we talk about a little grilling?
I think we should.
All right. I think Father's Day is a perfect segue. So a couple of things about grilling that I should mention before we start. The one thing I see that amateur cooks do more than professionals when they're grilling, two things. First of all, they don't oil the grill, which is critical to your success. You got to oil up your grill, and you can do it a couple of ways. You can take that spray, veggie spray, you know.
Pam
spray, yeah. Vigiline is another one. And you can spray the grates on the grill.
So I have to ask a question when you're talking about that. I went to the supermarket and my mother wanted Pam, the butter-flavored version.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And there's actually a couple of different options. A
couple of different Pams.
But there's one that's special for barbecues.
Oh, yeah, well, of course. Well, that's merchandising, you know what I mean? That's all it is. So you want to spray your grill and make sure. And if you don't have spray, the easiest way to do it is to take I use a rag in the restaurants, but you can probably take three or four pieces of a paper towel, you know, three or four, you know, when you rip them off, and then put them together and put some oil on them, some little vegetable oil, and then just rub the grates of the grill.
Vegetable oil.
Yeah, yeah, you don't want to waste olive oil.
So, but even before that, there's always a lot of discussion. How do you keep your grill clean? You know, you have some people's grills, and it's just
seasoned.
Horrific.
Yeah, seasoned. Well, you got to clean them. I mean, that's why they have grill brushes. I mean, you know, they don't make them for show. I mean, you know, and each grill usually comes with a set of cleaning tools. They have that scraper and a grill brush. And you can also take those grates off and do a real good job in the kitchen. You know, that's what I would recommend, you know. But I've done house parties where they say, you can use my grill, and I'll open up the grill, and it looks like a, you know, a prehistoric mess, you know. So thanks, but no thanks, you know, kind of thing. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's just a question of making sure that, you know, after every use, it's clean. And it's easier to clean the grill grates when it's hot than when it's cold, you know. So the time to do it is right when you're done, you know. You just brush it down. And
is it true that the real secret of grilling is to have a nice glass of wine in one hand as you do the grilling?
I would recommend it highly. I think it's fabulous. Yeah. The other secret is, and the other thing that amateurs don't do, is they don't give the grill time to work. They're constantly peeking to see, you know, is it done? Is it done? Is it done? Is it done? You know, you'll put a steak on it, look, and, you know, put a steak,
look. Well, that leads into the question, you know, what is actually the best temperature? Should you be using a thermometer? You know, some people, they got to have flames. And I guess that chars the wood. Does it actually sear the meat?
No, flames, I don't think flames are a great idea, because it burns the outside generally. And the other thing I was going to recommend, I'm glad you brought it up, is to always have a spray bottle of water near the grill. And when it does start to flame, because what will happen is sometimes with marinades, you know, there's a little oil in a marinade, or some of the fat will drip, you know, when it renders out of the side of the steak, that catches fire and you have a little grease fire going on there, and it burns the side of the steak, and you don't want to do that. So you want to just, if you have a little squeeze bottle of water, I mean, not a squeeze bottle, a spray bottle of water there, you can, you know, shoot that flame and keep it down. This way you'll get a nice even cooking thing on your steak or chicken or whatever without... The problem, too, with flames is you get all that carbon on there, and it gets that black look, and, you know, it's not pretty.
Right. So the bottom line is, if you achieve the right heat, and I'm led to believe that actually the more expensive grills are grills that have the most BTUs, mm-hmm. which I guess is the way you measure heat.
British thermal unit, yeah.
So, you know, basically having an evenly distributed environment to cook is probably the key. And
I advocate the opposite. I advocate different heat temperatures on different parts of the grill. And for two reasons. One is sometimes you'll cook something and it'll be done before the other thing's done, so you want to move that to the side of the grill that's not so hot, so it stops cooking, but you can keep it warm. So if you have that on real low, you know, it'll keep the thing warm while you're finishing the rest of it. Also, different meats require different temperatures. Like steak, you can do at a higher temperature than, let's say, chicken, because you don't want to burn the outside of the chicken and have it inside raw.
So let me ask you this. You know, you sit in a car, today's world, they have split zone air conditioning. So the person sitting next to you can have a warmer environment and you can have more chill. So when you have a barbecue that is at like a 3 zone or whatever,
right.
Can you actually like separate and cook
sure.
different things so
yeah.
that...
Yeah, you can, because there's a direct heat element to it. You know, it's like when you're sitting in the air conditioning in the car. If, you know, I'm on like 62 and you're on 71, you know, unless the thing's blowing right on you, it's all going to be 61 and 72 added up and divided by 2. It's all going to be, you know, kind of, it'll all get together. But
holy, I got to change the thing now, because now it's Tom Shawdell, radio host, restaurateur, author,
and weatherman.
And mathematician.
yes, that's me. I'm a mathematician. If I was good at math, I wouldn't be cooking. But anyway, the you know, the direct heat thing is easily, you know, put into different, you know, like temperature units. So you can have, like, say, a 500-degree grill in the middle and a 400-degree grill on the side or whatever, and a 200-degree grill over here. I always keep one side either off or close to off just to keep things warm while I'm screwing around with the rest of it, because you could be grilling vegetables and steak at the same time. Obviously, zucchini is going to be done quicker than a sirloin, so you would move that to either to a platter or to the side of the grill. It keeps it warm. You know?
Now, isn't it also important, like you might bring your steak out to the grill on a plate, and then it cooks, that it's probably better to use a fresh plate or wipe the plate that you brought out? Or...
Yeah, you don't want any residual stuff on there. The other thing to do is to – I always make sure that the stuff I'm going to grill – is close to room temperature before I start. Because if it's real cold, it's going to affect how it cooks.
So not good to put a frozen steak on the grill.
It's probably a really bad idea. It'll take a long time, you know. It's even a cold steak out of the refrigerator is a bad idea. Because it's so cold on the inside that it takes time for that thing to get warm. And then what happens is the outside tends to overcook, which seeps into the inside, so it'll appear medium rare in the beginning, and then by the time you slice it, it's medium to medium well. So you want to make sure that all your proteins are at room temperature, or close to room temperature. You just don't want them very cold, you know. And a lot of that is just technique and having that information to make your barbecue a little more successful. You know, you just don't go out there and just throw things on. There's a couple of things you should do, like we're saying. The other thing, too, is to, if you can, get a meat thermometer, because that's really a good way to tell, you know, when the meat is done. The other thing to do that a lot of people don't do is they'll take it off and they'll cut it right away and slice it and put it on a platter. Meat needs to rest. It needs to rest for about a good 5 to 8 to 10 minutes before you start slicing it, because the juices inside the meat will redistribute. When you cook a protein like that, all the liquid inside is forced to the center. That's why if you just take a piece of meat off and cut it right away, you'll see this really red thing in the middle and brown on the outside. You know, it'll appear like very, very rare in the middle, but medium all on the outside. Once it rests, that redistributes and you get that even color.
For grilling purposes, do you want a more fatty cut of meat, or should you still trim off like the perimeter fat and stuff like that?
Yeah, I do that anyway. I mean, the only fat that counts with meat is the one that's marbled in the flesh itself. You know, that ring of fat around like the outside of a New York strip is kind of useless. I mean, I don't know why people serve that, because you just got to cut it off anyway. Nobody eats it. It's gristle and fat, you know. I trim them before. So when I do, a 12-ounce steak, you know, my 12-ounce steak is 12 ounces of edible steak. You know, where I go to restaurants where they have a 12-ounce steak and you're cutting off an ounce or two of that stuff, that you know, the tailpiece, the covering, the fat covering layer on the one side, you know. I take all of that off before I cook it. I don't know why people serve it. It serves no purpose. It doesn't flavor the meat. It just adds to the weight. I mean, if that's the key, then it's a deception. If I have a 12-ounce steak, well, yeah, you do, but there's only about 10 ounces worth eating, you know. So it's essentially a 10-ounce steak, you know. My belief is when you cut everything off there, you trim that down to where it's, you know, there's none of that on there, and then you have a 12-ounce steak that's 12 ounces, you know. So
it's funny. I think that when you look in the butcher's case, some people think that it's got a good look when it's got that perimeter of fat.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I just think it's, you know, I remember saying to myself one day in the kitchen when I was cutting steaks, I'm like, why am I doing this? And I think a lot of it's just habit, you know. People just habit, and you do it. When you really start to think about some of these things, you go, maybe that's a lousy idea. Maybe I should just rethink this, you know. And so I had my epiphany early when it came to steak trimming, you know, and I've been doing it ever since. And it's funny because people, you know, when I had cool fish, I would do two things that the steakhouses wouldn't do. And one was I would trim all the fat off so you could eat the entire thing. You know, there'd be nothing left on the plate. And number two is I would make a paste. I'm going to let this out there and probably surprise a lot of people, but I would make a paste of very finely chopped garlic, extra virgin olive oil, pureed anchovies, canned anchovies, the salty kind, and some rosemary. And I would rub that on the steak. And what would happen would be the grill would burn off most of the quote-unquote fishy flavor that anchovies have. So you just get the salt, which steak needs a lot of salt. Most people don't salt their steaks enough. And you get a little hint of rosemary and garlic on there. And people say, your steaks are so good. It's so different, this, that, and the other thing. And if I told them why, because I rub it with anchovies, they'd either, you know, send it back or recoil in horror, right? But there's another little tip for you. If you steaks, if you're going to do steaks on the grill, you almost have to cover them in salt on both sides. Steaks never have enough salt. Now, what I do when I do my steaks is I always make a little, I always sprinkle them with some herbs. I'll use fresh thyme, fresh rosemary. Sometimes a little bit of garlic I'll rub on the outside. But they always have to be salted and peppered pretty heavily because that kind of burns away. And the difference between the heavily salted steak and the not so heavily salted steak is night and day. And you just have to trust me on this. Put on more than you think you need. And it's just like salting water for pasta. You know, the water, people put like a teaspoon of salt in 8 gallons of water for pasta, which is useless. It should taste like seawater. That's the way pasta water should taste. And it's the same with steaks. You can almost cover them in a layer of salt and be okay. I mean, that's probably a little extreme, but you can come close to that and be fine. So just make sure your steaks are well salted and well peppered before you put them on the grill.
I have to just break in. Last night I happened to have a meal over at Rothman's in East Norwich, and my goodness, it can't be just mind over matter. It really, the steak coming out of the kitchen is just perfectly seasoned, perfectly cooked. You know, depending on how you ask for it, but I tend to like my meat a little more well done than rare, so right. I did medium, but it was just perfection. And
the difference with steakhouses and cooking a steak at home is they have grills that reach temperatures of 1800 degrees, you know, which sears the meat on the outside and locks in the juices and flavor. And, you know, you don't have that at home. That's why people go to steakhouses. You can't replicate that in a house. You can kind of get it on a grill, but it's never going to be quite the same.
It was interesting. We had a client meeting, so we were there. And it was interesting. It was the three of us, but one person ordered swordfish, The other person ordered a veal chop, and I had a New York strip. But it was interesting that the guest that ordered the veal chop, he wanted it with peppers. Is that like a traditional way of serving it?
Yeah, that's kind of an Arthur Avenue.
Is that
thing,
like cherry pepper? What type of peppers is that usually?
Yeah, the Italian restaurants use those vinegar peppers. The ones that are marinated in a vinegar solution, and they put it into like a brown sauce, and it's that classic pork chop with vinegar peppers and
So he, the guest ordered that, and no, we don't have that. He goes, are you sure? Go back in there and look.
Yeah, I know. Ask the chef. The chef is really not. I love those questions. Most waiters will have all the information that the customer needs, as far as the menu goes, what we have, what we don't have. The one to go in and ask the chef is just, it's a pointless exercise in vanity is what it is, from the customer standpoint. And, the chef, on a perfect recitation of what the guy said, the chef usually has one eyebrow up and, are you kidding me? Can you get it? I'll give you an example. I don't know if you ever heard the story, but we had a guy come into a restaurant years ago when I was young. I was like 25, 26 years old, And a guy came into the restaurant, and I guess one person's al dente is another person's hard, So we put out these fingerling potatoes that were, in my opinion, al dente, and his opinion, too hard, right? So he says to the busboy in a ridiculous display of macho in front of the girlfriend, tell the chef that I want two more potatoes that aren't cooked like this, or I'll come in and shove them up as you know what, right? So I guess in an interest of full disclosure, the busboy comes in to me and goes, Jefe, the man on table 22, he said he's going to chub the papas and your culo. And I'm like, what? No, the man said it. The man, he told me to come and tell you he want new papas or he's going to chub them in your culo. Right? So I'm like, okay. I was a little more confrontational when I was younger. So I put two new potatoes on a little plate. I put a napkin over my arm, and I go out to the dining room, right? And I said, here, start shoving. And the guy says, what? I said, I heard you were going to shove these, whatever, Oh, no, I was, kidding. Oh, yeah, you weren't kidding when you thought I was some fat old French guy, But now this is a problem for you here, Anyway, all's well that ends well.
Just to conclude my Rothman story, I guess a lot of steak restaurants today do sushi and the steak. And,
sure, yeah.
And again, I love when other people make the decision on things, but whatever assortment of sushi that they served was incredible. It wasn't the choices wasn't ones with heavy spicy mayo on top. It was really basic sushi, and it was again just a perfect meal at Rothman's. I hadn't been there in such a long time.
Yeah, I don't go to steakhouses because I don't really eat a lot of steak, and I probably should go more often. Every once in a while, I get dragged there or whatever.
And I was reminded, we talked about it, I think, a couple of weeks ago because I had eaten at Mateo's in Huntington, but I guess the Zabaro-Scotto partnership has, I guess, been remodeled. So,
well, they split up.
So
they split up years ago.
Yeah, so Rothman's is part of the Mateo, includes Mateo's in their
group.
Yeah,
it's a Sbarro group.
So, but again, just well done. Not that Scotto doesn't do it well. They're doing phenomenal also.
No. Listen, both, excuse me, I partnered with Sbarro for a while with a couple of restaurants that we did that, and the partnership didn't work out. And it was a amicable split. It was just, everybody was, fine. I love those guys. They're great guys, and I have nothing but good things to say. But, I think what happens is, you have two powerful units there. You got, Mario Sbarro and you got Anthony Scotto, and both have, a tremendous amount of experience and success and ego. And, it's always hard to meld that together, And they went their separate ways. And as far as I know, that was an amicable split also, So
it seems to have worked out well.
Yeah, real well, Like I said, I like both of those guys. I mean, I have nothing but good things to say about Mario Sbarro. And the same goes true for Anthony Scotto. He's a great restaurateur, and he builds beautiful places.
So now back to the grill.
Back to the grill. Yeah. So, all right. So you're gonna oil your grill. You're gonna make sure it's, you know, your temperatures are right on there. You're gonna make sure you leave, especially steaks, on, you know, a little longer than you think, so it has time to sear and get those grill marks. And it'll also separate from the grill. The longer you leave it on, the easier it is to separate the meat from the grill. If it's not on there long enough, it doesn't sear the meat enough to separate it from the grill. It just sticks, and you have, you know, you pick it up and you have all those little pole things.
That happens a lot.
Yeah, it's because nobody's leaving it on long enough. You got to leave it on a while. So once you get all that, make sure you have your spray bottle of water, and you're ready to go. And the second thing I'd like to talk about as far as backyard barbecues go is to have what the French call mise en place, which means everything is together, all your ingredients are together and ready to go. When you have, we call it a place in the restaurant for short. When you got your place together, life is much easier on the line. You know, you have everything you need right in front of you. If your place isn't together and somebody orders the thing with tomatoes, now you're running downstairs, you're trying to get a tomato, now you got a chop, it's just a disaster. So, like I said, the French call it mise en place, and you got to have everything ready to go. So you want to have your steaks at room temperature. Now you're going to maybe grill some vegetables there, maybe corn on a cob, or maybe some grilled zucchini, which is always great. Portobello mushrooms, always great on the grill. Peppers you can do on the grill. Have them all cut and marinated with a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper and ready to go, you know. And you can put those on the side of the grill that's a little less hot, you know, because they won't take as long and they're a little more delicate than the meat would be. And you can time that perfectly so that it all comes off at the same time. Again, then you're going to rest your meat. You don't have to do that with chicken, but with pork or beef or anything like that, lamb, you want to rest it for about 10 minutes before you start slicing. Now, what if you have, you know, let's say steamed lobsters or something along those lines, you know? Well, you can do a couple of things. You can steam the lobsters or boil them. Let's say a pound and a half lobster would probably take you about 14 minutes or something like that, boiling it. Steaming, it's a little less, maybe 12. You can cut that in half, clean out the stomach sac and the line that runs down the tail, and then you can brush those with a little olive oil and put some grill marks on them. Or you can just, if you're going to have a fun backyard barbecue where you're going to pass out lobster crackers and everybody's going to have their own, you know, you can take those lobsters and just like I described years ago, corn on a cob, you can put them in a cooler and shut the cooler and you can keep those lobsters warm for hours. You know, so you can actually boil your lobsters, let's say an hour or two before you're going to do your grill, put them in the cooler, you know, seal the cooler down and leave them in the backyard so they're ready to go when you're ready to go.
And when you do that, is it best to have them wrapped in aluminum foil?
No, not at all. No, you just take the lobsters from the water, you know, when they're done, put them into the cooler, shut the cooler, and you're good to go. All right, and then you can split them later if you want, or you can crack them with, you know, the lobster crackers or whatever. But the great part about that is the lobsters are ready when the steak is ready. You don't have to worry about running back and forth from the kitchen to the thing. It's the same thing. If you have two coolers, you can do corn on a cob. And corn on a cob is another thing that people tend to overcook. Corn on a cob needs, if you're going to, like, say, boil it, it needs about 45 seconds. That's it. You know, people leave it in 2, 3, 4 minutes, 5 minutes. You don't need it that long. Corn is supposed to be sweet, crisp, and fresh. So all you really want to do is you want to set the color. You want to make that dull yellow corn into that bright yellow corn, which is what happens with the application of heat.
Cooking corn on the grill, in the husk or out of the husk?
You can do both ways. I mean, in the husk tends to keep it a little more protected and juicy.
And in today's world, a buzz of corn is Mexican street corn. How would you do that on the grill?
Well, basically, Mexican street corn is about the accoutrement. So what you're going to do is you're going to grill the corn on the grill, you know, to get that brown grill marks on there. And when you take it off, what they do is they take a chipotle-flavored mayonnaise. And chipotles are basically smoked jalapenos that are packed in adobo. And they're sold in cans in the, you know, in the international food departments of the stores. And what you do is you take however many you can stand, depending on your heat tolerance and how much you're making. Let's say you're going to make a cup of mayonnaise, a cup of aioli, you know, chipotle aioli. I would probably use maybe one or two peppers. And then you got to buzz them down in like a blender or something until it's a fine paste, and you mix that with mayonnaise. Now, that'll do it. I mean, I add a little more stuff because that's what I do. I tend to overcomplicate things. But to keep it simple, you can just use that puree and some mayonnaise. And what you want to do is you want to put that through a strainer. Like a little strainer, you can press it through with a rubber spatula just so you don't get any of the seeds in there. Because if you put in a squeeze bottle to kind of squeeze it over, you know, the seeds get stuck in the nozzle or whatever. So you don't want that to happen. But what they'll do is they'll squirt that with a little bit of chipotle, and then they usually sprinkle a cajita cheese on there, which is kind of like almost like a Mexican feta. You know, they sprinkle a little of that on there with some chopped cilantro, and they serve it usually with lime. So you can take a piece of lime and squeeze that on in, and you basically have Mexican street corn.
Wow.
So it's not really all that complicated. It's just about what you put on it. Yeah.
We're just talking about corn for the moment, but quick question. What is the Puerto Rican dish that people cook in corn husk? They use it like as aluminum foil or something, and then it's cooked.
Yeah, it's why can't I think of the name of it? It'll come to me. The tamales. And it's basically what they do is they'll take corn masa, almost like polenta, let's say, and they'll put a little of that in there, and then they'll add chicken, you know, like a chicken adobo or, you know, some kind of beef or shrimp or vegetables or whatever. And they steam that for usually, I don't know, an hour or whatever, you know, in those corn husks. And then what you do is you just peel the husk and you eat the inside. And there's tamales. So, and they're very good, you know. I mean, provided that, you know, the ingredients going in there are good. But they're, you know, they're a fun Mexican or South American dish. More from Mexico, I think, than South America. South America has a different set of empanadas and things.
So you're having people over to use to show off your grilling skills. What would you put out there that might not be expected, but it would be an unbelievable meal to serve?
A grill meal to serve. I would say something like a breast of veal.
Breast of veal?
Or a leg of lamb. You could do a leg of lamb on the grill, but you would have to have it boned and flattened out. And what I would do is I would stud that, you know, if you go to your butcher, if you like lamb, if you go to your butcher and have them bone a leg of lamb for you, it'll come out in almost like a big square, you know, probably, 18 inches or 17 inches by a foot, something like that. So you'll have this piece of meat, and you can probably get half of that if you don't need it all. But cut that in half, let's say, and then I would do is I would take a knife and make little slits. And I would put a clove of garlic in each slit, maybe about 8 or 10 of them. I would douse it with a little bit of olive oil and rosemary and some fresh thyme and let that marinate for, say, 5-6 hours, you know. And then put that on the grill. And again, you know, if you have your meat thermometer, you know, 110 to 15 is going to be rare. 120 to 22 is going to be medium rare. 25 to 30 medium, 35 to 40 medium well, 45 to 50, why did you do it, you know, kind of thing. And just, you know, see what temperature you want. I think lamb should be served medium rare. That's a fun thing to serve with like a Greek salad, you know. You can go a little Mediterranean there. You can also add maybe some bronzino, you know, again, spray that with a little olive oil and just hit it on the grill. It'll grill up really nice for you because there's a lot of oil in it. And then you could do some kind of a interesting little topping for the fish and or for the lamb. And what I like to use is I like to dry out tomatoes in the oven. I call them 8-hour tomatoes. We don't cook them for 8 hours anymore. I do them a little faster. But if you take plum tomatoes and you cut off the stem end, right, and then you just slice them in half lengthwise and then just season them with salt, a little bit of sugar, and some fresh thyme and olive oil. And I put them in like a 200 degree oven for about 3 or 4 hours until they dry out. And you peel those and chop those up. And then you mix them with like a little sauteed onion and garlic and some white balsamic vinegar and extra virgin olive oil and fresh basil. and mix that up when they're cold. You know what I mean? It's going to be like a cold topping. And you can serve that at room temperature. That goes right on the lamb or right on the fish. It makes a really great, you know, kind of topping for your fish. Another fun thing to do would be to grill some fruit, you know, for dessert. You can grill melons, anything. But my favorite is you can make like a grilled peach melba. Peach melba was a, you know, a dessert that was popular in the 40s and 50s. And it wasn't much of a big deal, but, you know, you can take a peach and, you know, cut it in half, take the pit out, right? And then I would slice off the bottom of each half just so it sits flat. You know, just take a little bit off so it's take the round off so it sits flat, and then just brush the other end, the pit end, with a little bit of olive oil, and then just put it on the grill. And again, don't peek; let it get nice and brown on the top. You know, then flip it over, and what'll happen is the peach will start to cook a little bit, so it'll bring out some of the natural sugars. You know, and then once they're done, you can let them cool a couple of minutes, and you set them in a bowl. Now you have a perfect bowl within a bowl, right? So you have this bowl with this peach that's the shape of a bowl where the pit was a little cutout, right? So you take a little scoop of vanilla ice cream, put that in there, a little raspberry syrup on the top, which you can make from raspberry puree, or you can make take raspberry preserves and cook them down or whatever, and just drizzle that over and put some fresh raspberries and whipped cream, and now you have a grilled peach Melba
that
dessert.
That's delicious.
Yeah, it's fun. It's easy. It's summer. It's great.
So you got me thinking back towards memory lane. When I was a Boy Scout, used to cook on the campfire.
I'm picturing you in the uniform, and it's making me smile.
Yeah, nice yeah. shorts.
Yeah.
High socks.
Oh, yeah. I hope you had some tan on them gams, because...
But a chuck steak, is that a steak you would grill, or that's more...
It's a steak you should chuck. It's what you should do with
it. What's that? What type of cut of meat is that?
It's a tough cut of meat. It's from the... Chuck is from the four legs of the animal, and, you know, it's a type of... It's the type of steak that people cook. If you're going to cook it, you better slice it thinly, because it's going
to
be tough.
So what we used to do is we take the chuck steak, we put like an envelope of Lipton's onion soup, and then you put some sliced carrots, julienne carrots, uh-huh. and some potato,
right.
and you'd make a tent. You'd enclose it in aluminum foil, and you would throw it on the campfire. And
tell me this was part of the survival test, because...
Well, somehow I survived, but you're saying I should ditch that one.
Yeah, chuck in the garbage. Now, a chuck steak, is again, it's from the forefront of the animal. You know, you can... Here's a way to tell if a piece of meat is going to be tender or tough, and you can apply it to your own body. The muscles that are used the most are the toughest. So anything that comes from the legs, the hind quarter, the fore quarter, the places where the animal's moving... are going to be the toughest parts. The parts where the rib cage, you know, the tenderloin, you know, those areas don't get so much use. So it's not like the cows out there doing sit-ups or push-ups. So, you know, that those muscles don't get used as much, and those are more tender. Generally, I would take chuck. They grind it a lot for hamburgers. You know, you always see chuck, ground chuck, you know. And you can stew it. You know, you can make great beef stew, beef bourguignon, you know, pot roast, that kind of thing out of chuck steak. If you're going to grill chuck steak, you know, because it's less expensive, that's fine. But again, you better make sure that you slice it thinly, because it's going to be chewy and tough. Yeah, you don't want to, you know, certain types of meat that, you know, you're better off for braising and you know, cooking for long periods of time to break down the muscle tissue. And then, you know, then you have cuts like filet mignon, which need almost no time, you know, and you can cut it with a fork. So, but that's really the way you check it out, you know. Well, listen, let's take a little break. We'll sell some commercial time here, and we'll come back and continue this show.
Sweet Fancy Long Island is the award-winning dessert and pastry company that has become one of the hottest sources for bakery treats available for delivery on Long Island. Each mouth-watering creation has a personality all its own, teasing the palate with its rich flavors, complex textures, and eye-catching presentations. All items at Sweet Fancy Long Island are made 100% from scratch using the highest quality ingredients, Belgian chocolate, European butter, vanilla beans from Tahiti, and the richest, most flavorful fruits available. Their clients can enjoy any one of our delectable confections from one-of-a-kind pastries, specialty and occasion cakes, French macarons, and karma cups. Their signature line includes an assortment of charming, personalized size desserts served in miniature mason jars. The Sweet Fancy Long Island team takes great pride in presenting a unique, delicious, and elegant dessert experience, and works closely with every client to create create a memorable dessert that will add an exciting dimension to any celebration. Presently, the work of Sweet Fancy Long Island have been found in some of the area's top restaurants, country clubs, gourmet shops, catering facilities, and Food Network. Go to sweetfancyli.com to order online or to view their incredible gallery of desserts.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing With Fire on 1100 WHLI, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show. With your host, Tom Shordell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
All right. So in the spirit of Father's Day, do you have any one Father's Day experience that you remember? Or
again, the legacy my mom and dad will leave is family. And so holidays are meant to be shared and... You know, my dad looked forward to birthdays and Jewish holidays for gathering. My mom, as I've said before, was an unbelievable cook. And the house would be overtaken by guests, and it was just always a wonderful environment to grow up. And I just pray that my children get that. And I think they do. That's actually, to me, really, really again, a real true measure of what footprint you leave here when you journey onward.
Yes, yes. Well, I got to tell you, my father's side of the family, for years, and I'm talking from the time I was like five or six until I was probably in my early 30s, had a Father's Day picnic every year at Belmont Park over in West Islip, West Babylon, I mean. And it was funny, and nobody could remember exactly. They had a banner, you know, the fourth annual, eighth annual, you know, it got into the 20s, and nobody could figure out if it was the 21st, 23rd, whatever. But what was great about it is I had my father's cousin's family. We had some musicians in there. My cousin George played the clarinet and the saxophone. My father was a clarinet and saxophone guy. I'm a guitar player. My cousins Richie and Robert were guitar players. So it used to be, you know, when we were kids, it was kind of boring because we would bring our guitars and we want to play Beatles songs. And the parents would all get, you know, tuned up and, you know, they want to sing those, you know, 5'2", Eyes of Blue and, you know, all of those old standards, right? So I knew all those songs before I knew Jimi Hendrix. I knew how to play Heart of My Heart, 5'2". And it was funny. My father would complain that all our music sounds the same. Oh, your music sounds the same. It's the same stuff. I said, so we're at the Father's Day picnic one day, right? And he says, all right, listen, I want you to play 5'2". I don't know 5'2". All right, give me a C. I said, well, what are the chords? He goes, it's C, A7, G7, D7, and E7. I said, okay, how about Redhead? You know Redhead? No, I don't know Redhead. It was before I was born. All right, it's C, A7, G7, D7, and E7. All right, how about that old Gang of Mine? You know that one? I don't know that one. It's C, A7, G. I said, wait a minute, all my stuff sounds the same? You haven't had a different chord pattern yet, you know? So we were laughing. My cousins and I would get a kick out of it because we'd be sitting there forced to play these songs that we hated. And the parents were all like, you know, 16 beers into the night, you know, and singing into the microphone. It was hilarious. But as we got older, it was more and more fun because we all became better musicians. And it started to really gel. It was, I mean, we started to sound pretty good together. It was an awful lot of fun. And I just remember those days, you know, looking forward to that because I didn't see those cousins of mine all that much, maybe once or twice a year. And to jam with them and you know, and to, you know, make music with them was always so much fun, because music is a language that, you know, if you know it, you can speak to anyone. It's like, you know, being able to speak Spanish in Mexico or whatever, you know. Once you know the material, it's universal. So, you know, whether, you know, I played with my cousin before or not, you know, we can play together. I mean, it may not sound like Simon and Garfunkel, but it's certainly, you know, two people who know the material and can play music. And really good things happen, especially after the fifth glass of wine, you know, because you sound way better than you did before the first, you know. But it was just so much fun and so much... you know, family thing, and it was kind of celebrating the fathers, I guess, because there was multiple generations of fathers there. We probably had 30, 40 people at each one of these things. There would always be a softball game, you know. Well, the musicians were terrible. The athletes were good, you know.
But in the old days, that I guess it still happens. I think it's a different population of the community. But in the old days, there were family circles. And again, all these gatherings at, like, Bear Mountain or Eisenhower Park, and I guess you'd make a reservation and reserve an area, and they would have these built-in grills.
That's what we did.
Everybody would bring a grill.
Sure.
And it was like, you know, once a year you did that. And so many times today, everybody's in such a need of doing different things that's an event almost of yesteryear.
Yeah, I'm not so sure that isn't by design. I mean, they've been trying to break up the families forever, you know. It's terrible, but it's true. I mean, you know, the government's always, you know, and I don't want to get into that. But anyway, the bottom line is, you know, we've drifted apart. You know, I'm guilty of it. Everybody I know is guilty. I mean, there's some families that still do everything together. You know, when I was partners with Mark Beige over in Jewel, I mean, I never saw anything like it. His family, they did everything together. I mean, it was wonderful to watch, you know?
Well, I have a friend that actually, it's quite philosophical, but people, like, get crazed that they must attend a funeral, but yet, when the person's alive, yeah, I mean, they never spend time with
them. Yeah, it's a good point, you know? Yeah, it's true. And you know, I don't know if it's just life gets busier, we're distracted by social media, or, you know, even now texting. I mean, you know, even I'm texting. I'm the least technical person out there, you know, technological person, I should say. But, you know, it takes the human interaction out of it. It almost becomes robotic, you know. And you don't get nuance. You don't get, like, subtleties, you know, a tone of voice, an attitude or whatever that you get when you're speaking to somebody. I get so PO'd when somebody texts me and goes, call me. What? Why didn't you just call? You know, I don't get it, you know. It's just, I don't know. I don't think so. It was George Goebbels once said, George Goebel, I should say, it's a different guy, completely different guy. Sorry, George. But George Goebel, I was watching him on Johnny Carson one day, and he says, you know, I feel like the whole world's a black tuxedo and I'm a pair of brown socks. I'm starting to feel like I know what he meant, you know. I mean, the whole world's passing me by somehow.
So before we get back into the grilling thing and Father's Day,
I just wanted
to share a couple of quick things. One is I had a dish at a restaurant that I don't even know why it was on the menu, but it was steak tips fusilli.
Oh, no.
And apparently it was like in a brown peppercorn sauce.
Oh, boy.
And it was slices of steak, mushrooms, and it was terrible. I mean, should fusilli be in a peppercorn sauce?
You sure it didn't say it's silly? Don't order it.
Yeah. Oh, you would find the humor in that.
You know what's amazing to me? You know what steak tips are?
I'm afraid to know.
It's like spicy tuna roll. It's a way to get rid of the stuff that nobody would eat, you know? And I don't mean that it's bad or it's rotten or anything like that, but it's the ends of the steak that you can't make a steak out of, you know? You got to do something with them. So instead of doing something interesting, like when I was a kid, you know, I worked in a steakhouse and we had steak tidbits, they were cool. And they were the ends of the steak that you would trim is what they were, you know? Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just kind of a silly use for it. I would like, I use trim. I use it all the time. I mean, you got to do it economically. It makes sense, you know. But I'll take the ends of the filet mignon and stuff, the trim that's left. You know, I'll make bolognese sauce or something out of it, like something like that, where it's so disguised. Like I said, half of my job is being a chef. The other half is being an alchemist.
Wait, so that reminds me. Sunday night, we went out to dinner for a graduation dinner. We went up to Bethpage to It's called the Heritage Club, and their outside area is called the Social Club, a social house.
Yeah.
Basically, it's where all the golfers come off the course,
sure.
And they have a meal. On the menu, and I keep seeing this more often, your friend that has the Bethpage Burger Bar
right.
also has a similar item. But they have a burger with lobster on top
right.
with cheese.
Oh, good.
Here at this restaurant, it was sliced filet with lobster and cheese. And I don't get it. What is this lobster and steak and cheese?
I mean, lobster and steak has been a combination for, you know,
but like
time
it's two things side by side on a
yeah.
on a plate. This is like a sandwich.
Cheese and lobster to me is, you know, just it's a felony.
So at the
it's
burger bar,
felony.
I always ask for the cheese on the side. And you actually get some a couple of pieces of nice lobster with it and the burger. So you can't go wrong. What I was amazed at up at in Bethpage at the Heritage House, theirs was a filet mignon and lobster slider. But what was amazing about it, I didn't think about it, and I got it with the cheese, which was a mistake. But the filet actually was very, very tender, as compared to what you were just talking about with, you know, steak tips that might be random
sure.
pieces that might be tender, might not be tender. But, you know, something that to the real story about all this is we got up there for a dinner at 6 o'clock, and they gave us the lunch menu.
Oh.
A little perturbed.
Yeah, I would think.
But it worked out because the food was really, really good.
Uh-huh.
And when I had called up the next day as only I could, they apologized because 6 o'clock, you know, they really should have had the dinner menu out.
You would think, yeah.
So,
yeah.
But it turned out it was a high school graduation, so the kids found what they wanted and the parents found what they wanted.
Yeah.
So it worked out. But again, I don't get cheddar cheese on top of lobster and filet.
I think it's people looking to either make something different, make an impression, you know, create a fad or whatever. I don't know what it is. Just searching for all the wrong things. And you know, but without that kind of thought process, you know, food never moves ahead and or behind, depending on the idea. You know, you take a guy like John George who started the world juicing, you know, and using vegetable juices as sauces, you know. That was a brilliant move. But somebody had to take the step. I don't think putting cheddar cheese on a lobster is a brilliant step, and it's certainly not innovative. It's just kind of, you know, what do I have here? I got this, I got that, the other thing. All right, slap them together, and here we go, you know. Or maybe it's like my own thing. Nobody else has this, thank God. You know, but, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what causes all that. And I've been guilty of it. I mean, you know, we all try and find something, the missing note, you know, the musicians are looking for. You know, the chefs are always trying to find that next thing that's going to excite the public and get them in. And, you know, we all have our own take on it. So sometimes it's a good idea. And I've had my share of bad ideas, just like everybody else, you know. I mean, I've done some dishes that just bombed miserably, you know. Things that I thought might have been, you know, great. And I remember one time I made this guava ketchup, you know, to put on a fish. And it was mostly met with, you know, garlic cloves and crosses. Nobody went near it, you know. And I think I still have it somewhere in the freezer, you know. And that was 20 years ago.
Wow.
I was talking to Michael Meehan one time, who's a great chef and a dear friend. And we were going down to Florida together. And we were talking about some of our greatest screw-ups, you know, which is way more entertaining than the successes, you know. And he said, yeah, I had a bunch of tomatoes hanging around the kitchen one time. And he said, these are yellow tomatoes, the green zebra tomatoes. And he says, I did a tomato tartare. I thought it was brilliant. I had like four little colored tomatoes all tartared up with accoutrements, you know, capers and onions, this, that, and the other thing, and egg yolk. It was just like, you know, steak tartare without. He goes, I didn't sell one all week. I'm like, even I knew that was a bad idea. You know, he's, what are you talking about? How about your guava ketchup? Oh, yeah, all right, you know.
Well, it was a good thought. So in response to my ongoing request for people to interact with us,
mm-hmm.
We had an email this past weekend from Eileen Moriarty.
Okay.
Hi, Tom. And it was in relation to coming of age. And we had talked about what, you know, when you went from chicken fingers to
sure.
something. So, hi, Tom. You probably don't remember me. I'm Alan Moriarty's
yes,
wife.
Yes, of course I remember, Eileen.
A friend of ours mentioned that she heard you asking a couple of weeks ago for stories about the first time people were allowed to, as children, to yeah. order on their own. My family dined frequently at the Arbor Inn in Rockville Center.
Ah, the Arbor Inn. I remember it.
On our 16th birthday, my father and mother would take us there and allow whoever was celebrating to order his or her first adult meal. Once my brother announced that he wanted frog's legs, my father asked if he was certain that that was what he wanted. John said yes, that he always wanted to try them. They were delivered. I guess she means served.
Yeah.
My brother gave them a weird look, ate them, and didn't say another word throughout the rest of the dinner.
The rest of his life.
Afterward, my dad asked how they were, and John said they were okay, but he didn't think he'd order them again. Bottom line, he's now 73, and true to his word, has never had another order of frog's legs since that night. Hope all is well with you, Courtney and the grandkids. Regards,
great.
Eileen.
Eileen and Alan were two of my best customers ever. I think Alan came to two wine dinners on the same day. I was doing two different events. He came to both of them. It was fabulous. I mean, nicest people. And hello, Alan. Hello, Eileen. Hope you're listening. And
so
we
with
miss
that,
seeing you.
With that, share with us some barbecue pictures, stories, the most best barbecue, the world's worst barbecue. It's fun to read. Tom and I always read what you guys send in to us. But the way to reach out to us is at fire@whli.com, fire@whli.com.
I was doing a barbecue one time as a catering gig out in Pominock Vineyards, you know. And so Kareem, the owner, said, you know, I have some vine clippings here if you want to use them instead of charcoal or wood. And I'm like, how cool is that? It doesn't get any more local than vine clippings from the thing. So I said, yeah. So he had a whole bunch of them piled up out there. So I put them on the grill. I'm thinking, I don't know if they're green or not. They're going to burn, you know.
That's what my mind went to. Was it dry enough or was it just a smoky mess?
I decided because I'm a professional and this was a 200-person party that I was going to make sure they burned. So I went and I got a gallon of gasoline, right? Sunoco 260 or whatever it was, high test. So anyway, I pile these things up. I put the gasoline on them because they didn't have lighter fluid. I lit a match and I became an eyewitness to Armageddon. You had to see this thing. Boom, it took off. Like I had like a 3-alarm fire behind a tent.
But you do have eyebrows.
I do. So I Diane comes running out. My manager comes running out of the tent. She goes, people complain it's hot in the tent. It's hot in the tent. Do you need water? I need a hook and ladder is what I need. I need a bumper truck, you know. Oh, my God, what a mess.
Hence the title of the book.
Hence, we had
playing with fire.
We actually had. I had to get the thing away from the tent because I didn't want to burn the entire vineyard to the ground. Right, so we couldn't get near the fire. It was so hot. So we're crawling on our bellies, and we wrapped napkins around the wheels, and we pulled it back. You know, like Navy SEALs. You know, oh, what a disaster! I'm telling you, I have some stories. Anyway, I think. we should probably talk about maybe some successes. So, anyway. Let's pay attention to what I said in the beginning. Again, to recap, make sure you oil your grill. You know, make sure it's clean. Don't peek at your meat. You know, don't get caught peeking at your meat. Just make sure you lift that, you know, after 5 or 6 minutes. You want to make sure that that's going to release from the grates. Have different temperatures on your grill for different, you know, settings for you know, proteins that would require a little more cooking on the hot side and maybe vegetables or chicken that would require a little less temperature on the cooler side. And then the side of the grill where you can keep things warm and let your meat rest. You know, let your proteins rest for 5 minutes before slicing them. Other than that, I have no advice. I think you should go out there, barbecue yourselves crazy, have fun. It's going to be a great day today. Happy Father's Day to all you dads out there. You know,
dads, and granddads,
grand-granddads, granddads,
and
everybody.
Fathers-to-be.
Right. And if coming from my golfer soul, if dad wants to watch the U.S. Open, could you please leave him unmolested? So on that, we're going to close the show with Tom's Three Keys to Life, which are life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last and keep chocolate in your life is as important as sex and pizza.